Hello everyone and welcome back to the Next Page podcast. Today I have the pleasure to have with me in the studio Corinne Momal-Vagnan, who is the Executive Director of the Kofi Annan Foundation here in Geneva, not far from the Palais des Nations. And we're going to explore an intriguing topic today, the nexus between democracy and multilateralism. How do these two fundamental ideas interact and shape the global landscape of international relations? Corinne, welcome back to the Next Page. You've been our guest before in episode 30, and at that time you told us a little bit of the history of the Foundation. But for those who may not know the Foundation and yourself, can you please introduce yourself right from the start and explain your role at the helm of the Kofi Annan Foundation?
Thank you, Francesco. And first of all, thank you very much for having me again on the Next Page. It's a pleasure and it's an honor. I worked for the United Nations for over three decades in various locations, and I had the great privilege of working directly with Kofi Annan during his mandate as Secretary General. And 3 years ago, I took over the Kofi Annan Foundation. So when he stepped down from the United Nations, Kofi Annan established a small foundation here in Geneva to help him with all the activities he still had to do in mediation, advocacy. So both in activities that were at the global level in shaping policy responses, but also sometimes in very specific country situations. So basically, Kofi Annan, unfortunately, has been gone for 5 years, but the foundation is very much still here and pursuing his legacy. And one of the areas in which it works hard to build on this legacy is the promotion of democracy.
Well, that's great, and it's a perfect segue in the conversation of today. So let's perhaps first explore a little bit of the foundation and democracy, because these are really two things that go together. The foundation has a specific overarching focus on democracy. So before we start our explanation of the nexus, let's define the two key terms we'll be discussing today: multilateralism and democracy. I'll let you do that. We know a few things about multilateralism here in this library and archives, but you're the invited guest, so you have the honor to give the definition.
Thank you, thank you. That's quite the challenge. For democracy, it's relatively easy if you look at the Greek etymology of the word. It's just government by the people. But frankly, that doesn't give you much. So I like very much to define democracy by Article 21 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And let me just read you the Article 21, because it gives you a much more concrete understanding what government by the people means. And it is Article 21. Everyone has the right to take part in the government of his or her country directly or through freely chosen representatives. Everyone has the right to equal access to public service in his or her country. And the will of the people, and that's important, the will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of the government. This will shall be expressed in periodic and genuine elections, which shall be by universal and equal suffrage. So I think this is a beautiful definition, really, and we don't have to look much further than the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Multilateralism, on the other hand, is much more, I think, complicated to define. So I've seen many, many definitions. The one I like the best is probably the one that was given by a former close associate to Kofi Annan, actually, John Ruggie, who was also senior advisor on human rights and business, and did a lot of work in the multilateral system. So if you take the dictionary definition, it says that the multilateralism is the process of organizing relations between groups of three or more states. But that really also doesn't give us much. So some people say to this just basic quantitative definition, you have to add a qualitative definition, which is that multilateralism means the indivisibility of interest among participants, a commitment to diffuse reciprocity. And this is what John Ruggie really insisted on, is this diffuse reciprocity. and a system of dispute settlements intended to enforce a particular mode of behavior. So John Ruggie just simplified it, and he said it's an institutional form that coordinates relations among three or more states on the basis of generalized principles of conduct. Okay, and I really like this. And that shows you from the start the interaction between democracy and multilateralism, because they are basically both based on the legitimacy of the decision-making process, the aspiration to a fair rule-based order, and the trust that others will respect those rules. Okay, and I think this is at the core of the multilateral crisis and the democracy crisis that we maybe will discuss, is the fact that this trust is being eroded, that we are all playing by the same rule book, and that I trust that we decided on these rules together and you will implement them and I will also apply them.
We'll certainly go back to this because it's one of the key areas of our exploration today. Indeed, you're totally right. Before we go there, though, I wanted to perhaps clarify for the audience the significance of democracy as a value or ideal to the work of the foundation. I remember in episode 30, you told us a little bit more about the history of the foundation, how it works, you know, what it is. But now, since we're talking about this nexus between democracy and multilateralism, I think it's worth the effort for the audience to understand, you know, why the foundation focuses so much on democracy. There are so many things in the legacy of Kofi Annan himself. So, yeah, why?
Well, you have to remember precisely that when Kofi Annan was Secretary General, it was probably the heydays of multilateral action and of democratization. The 1990s and the early 2000s saw a wave of enthusiasm for democracy. So United Nations created the Division for Electoral Assistance. It created the UN Democracy Fund. There was an International Day for Democracy decided by the General Assembly. The General Assembly had the resolution every other year on support to new and restored democracies. So there was a sense that the people, the will of the people, had to be respected. And going back to the definitions that I read, and a sense that we had to go back to the origin of the Charter and the first words of the Charter, which is "we the people." So the UN Charter doesn't mention democracy, but it starts with the words "we the people." So it is all about democracy. And so that wave carried Kofi Annan, and it became really part of him, and he was this great enthusiastic leader that pushed for democracy not as an abstract concept, but bringing it down to people all over the world that really wanted to have a say in how they were governed. And he continued this, so he brought this enthusiasm to the foundation, and from the start he made it one of the key areas of focus. And early on, in 2012, he established a commission on electoral integrity that published a seminal report on electoral integrity. So he always saw the electoral integrity as the bedrock of democracy, as this is where it starts and this is how legitimacy is ensured. However, he always had a very wide understanding of democracy, and we can come back to this later, but knowing that it's not just about elections, certainly. So he pushed from the start, he pushed his foundation to get into the issues of elections and democracy. And later, when he saw that democracy established including in established democracies, was crumbling under the attack of different forces, including that of disinformation and social media, he established another high-level commission, which is called the Kofi Annan Commission on Democracy and Elections in the Digital Age, which really looked at what are the weaknesses of democracy today and how you can strengthen it and reverse the unfortunate trend we see today about the weakening of democracy in the north, in the south, in the east, in the west.
But let's talk about this trend, because you're perfectly located on the landscape to observe. So you have this privileged observation deck as a foundation on the thing that we call democracy around the world. So what are the trends? How many, you know, how much of the world is led by fair democracies? And in established democracies themselves, what do you mean when you say, you know, there is a negative trend of erosion and things like that? So what are the trends today?
Well, the trends are very clear, and I will quote you a study that is published every year by something which is called VDEM. It's Variety of Democracy Institute. It's based at the University of Göteborg in Sweden. And they look at democracy as a continuum. Now, it's not like some countries are democracies and some are not. So they look more at the weakening or strengthening of democracies, at the slow move towards autocratization. And what they have said is basically, in their latest report that was just published a few years ago, is that advances of global levels of democracy made over the past 35 years have been completely wiped out. In other words, we are today back where we were in 1986 in terms of democracy. And they say also that 72% of the population today live in autocracies in 2022. There's a very interesting phenomenon of electoral autocracies around the world, and they look also at that. It's, you know, sometimes governments are elected in full legitimacy through free and fair elections, but these governments, once they take power after free and fair elections, weaken the democracy in many, many ways, in particular freedom of expression, the independence of the judiciary. And this is a phenomenon we've seen on many continents. So it's not going in the right direction. And all the studies, not only VDEM, but there is International IDEA that publishes also a yearly assessment of democracy in the world, Freedom House, many. It's clear it's all going in the wrong direction in the last two decades in particular. And that trend is somewhat accelerating. And when I talk about established democracy, what we've seen is very clear, whether it was in Brasilia or Washington, some very established democracies have seen attempts to subvert the choice of the people in recent elections, you know? So you have to see that there is not, you cannot take it for granted anywhere in the world. People are not happy with what the governments have delivered everywhere. People are not happy because governments have not delivered social and economic equity. They're not delivering solutions to the big challenges of our time, including climate change. So people want democracy, but they see what their democratic government are delivering, and they're not happy.
I see. That is also a nexus that that is different from the one we're exploring now, but I think it's complementary. We may want to bring this concept back when we look at what happens in that nexus. So if you agree, let's dive in. Let's go into this space that we call the nexus. And so let's explore a little bit, because the connection is very intricate, indeed. So on the one hand, multilateralism may contribute to the strengthening and enhancing of democratic value. You said it yourself. There are elements of continuity between the two ideals, the two values. On the other hand, democracy as a system could lead to better, more proactive postures by nation states in the arena of international relations in terms of respecting and trusting, you know, a multilateralism. We're not seeing much of that now, but there may be reasons for that. But let's go in order. Let's look, perhaps, in which ways democracy can serve and support multilateralism and vice versa. I think this is where a lot of work of the being done by the Kofi Annan Foundation provides you with a sort of a privileged kind of outlook on this. You know, how democracy would help the world uphold and have a better multilateralism, in your opinion?
Yeah, it's, you know, what is interesting is that this relationship, this interaction between multilateralism and democracy is not well understood. And we ourselves, in fact, at the foundation are going to start a project over the next 2 years to look at this nexus. So this is a really good conversation, Francesco. Thank you, because it for me, it's the beginning of this project.
Then you have to come back.
We will come back after the 2 years to say what our analysis has yielded. We know there are studies that show that democracies tend to be more cooperative in the international arena. And this is partially because of what I said, because democracy is based on the notion of a rule-based order and the trust in everybody applying the same rules. We know that democratic states have been better at in areas such as trade, investment, human rights protection, humanitarian assistance even. So there is a sort of empirical evidence that democratic states have been better at engaging in international cooperation. Many exceptions to this, overall. We don't really understand all the mechanisms how this is done. I think this is also probably due to the fact that they represent more genuinely their citizens. Because at the end of the day, international cooperation, of course, multilateralism is cooperation between states. But at the end of the day, it's about the people. We go back again to the citizens. So if a state is not a legitimate representative of all their citizens, chosen through free and fair elections, but chosen through a process that will give it legitimacy, how can it represent the interest of all their population in the multilateral setting? So I think this is at the core, really, what it is about. We have seen, conversely, that multilateralism helps protect democracy or encourage democracy, not only through the various programs that I mentioned that the United Nations had, but in itself, participating in a multilateral forum gives a government an incentive to look at the longer-term issues more than just the narrow electoral cycle. And this is true, for instance, it's very difficult for elected politicians to deal with the long-term consequences of climate change, because you have immediate imperatives of the next elections. I have to decrease unemployment. I have to reduce the deficit in the balance of trade, and so on. So it's very difficult. So cooperating in a multilateral system forces you to look at the main global issues of today, and that's a very good thing. And also, of course, the multilateral system has put in place a very strong normative framework, and states have to report, for instance, to the human rights treaty bodies about their implementation of the norms that they have signed up to. Okay, so I think there is this really reinforcing relationship between the two. But as I said, it really deserves looking more at it. And for instance, it's very interesting, but the same institute, VDEM, that I mentioned, based at the University of Gothenburg, has published a series of briefs on, does democracy help with global health? Does democracy help with climate policies? And that's really interesting, because they go and see whether democracy, being a, you know, democratic state, will more readily, for instance, cooperate in a multilateral agreement on the prevention of pandemics, for instance, because maybe democratic states tend to be more transparent, believe in the freedom of information, which are key to the prevention of pandemics, right? The transparency of information. So there are many aspects to this complex relationship.
And if we have to add one nuance in favor of what you're saying, I think there is evidence to show that multilateralism, being in transition, is going somewhere. It's not going in a situation of chaos. The trajectory is clear. It's going to a place where, on the one hand, you have global problems overarching, they are impossible to tackle by single nations or coalitions of nations. So, for example, let's take climate change. But if we want to complicate our life, then we can take the overarching, ongoing, never-ceasing migration crisis, for example. And on the one hand of the spectrum, you have this. The new global problems weren't there in 45, they're there now, and they're there to stay. On the other side of the spectrum, you have individualization of what is discussed in multilateral forum. So if I'm a citizen, I do care about climate change as an individual before I care about it as a government. So I have a stake in this. And so in a way, I become attracted to the multilateral discussion as I start thinking, hey, I how do I have a say there? Because this has a direct bearing on my life and my descendants, for example, my family. And so this may help also to visualize another link between those countries in which that individual is able also to select his government and select the government also based on the stance that this government has in areas that before were only reserved and recognized exclusively for governments to exercise. So that is another thing. Yet there is a conceptual notion that we should discuss in this podcast, which is, you said it before, the trends are pretty clear, that now going, you know, the tide is going backwards in a way. Yet multilateralism is the business of all members of the international community, whether they embrace the value of democracy or not. So multilateralism is this space for everyone to have a dialogue. How do we square that circle?
Yes, because I think we have to move away from a very narrow definition or concept of democracy as some kind of Western imposed model, and that lots of other countries don't have their own models, which the UN always says. I mean, there's not a single model of government that the UN will push on anybody. But everywhere in the world, and all the surveys show that there's a pretty steady and stable level of population, about 80%, that always answer the survey saying, and they don't always say, we want democracy, although often they do. They say, we want a legitimate government that represents all our interests, that work for all of the communities in the country and not simply one or two privileged communities, that will deliver services, and that is accountable, basically. And this is true. This is true. I mean, everyone wants this, from China to Chile, from the US to South Africa, from Russia to Spain. Everyone wants a government that is fair, that is legitimate, that represents their interests, that will take care of their needs, and that is accountable. So if you take that lens, you understand that all the countries come together and hopefully want the best for their citizens. How they assess that they represent, they really speak on behalf of the citizens, that's another matter. But basically, everyone comes to the UN to solve the problems that their citizens are confronted with. And if you take this lens, then there's no squaring the circle. For me, it's fine. You know, it's logical. The problem is that more and more people don't see that actually this is what happens in the multilateral setting. And I saw that that the recent surveys show, although the United Nations, which is the main institution of the multilateralism, although people still overall have a positive image of it, they do see it as disconnected from their lives, from their needs. And the latest Pew Research Center study showed that 50% of people around the world say that the UN deals, only 51% said the UN deals effectively with international problems. So they see it as disconnected from the real problems of today. And this is probably a reflection that when the governments come, they don't necessarily bring the interests of their citizens with them. So for me, the decrease, it's perfectly natural and logical that the de- sort of the crisis of multilateralism has happened at the same time as the crisis of democracy. It's logical. And this is why it was really interesting to me that just last week in July, in the 53rd session of the Human Rights Council, for the first time in a very long time, the words democracy were mentioned. And there was a joint statement by about 50 countries led by Georgia, but from all continents. There was Costa Rica, Fiji, Moldova, Gambia. So all continents, there were many countries that issued a statement which basically said that the crisis of democracy is at the heart a crisis of human rights. So they wanted to bring back into the UN this issue of the crisis of democracy. And they called on the Human Rights Council to really take a leading role in the global reinvigoration of democracy. So it was the first time in a long time that I saw that a considerable number of member states from all continents may be sensing that the multilateral system is no longer maybe taking the interests of all citizens in all countries at heart, wanted the issue of democracy brought back in the multilateral setting. And maybe it is a turning point.
And maybe the Council is looking at what we're exploring today, became aware of this deeper nexus between human rights and therefore multilateralism and democracy. So I think it's becoming, as we go in the exploration, it's becoming more and more evident that the nexus is intricate yet very powerful, very important. Like it's really a fundamental structure linking the two. So there is more that meets the eye in the literature we can see in terms of literature on international relations. I mean, when we look at we said it before, multilateralism being in transition, you know, it's always been in constant evolution, but there are more pressure elements now in pushing this transition, and global crises are, in the plural, are one of those. But when we look at transition and future and foresight, there are two drivers of change that are very important. One is youth and the other one is technology. And both are, the Kofi Annan Foundation has looked into this. And I know, for example, that you're famous for really pushing, empowering, and bolding the action of youth. You are among the first global players to recognize youth as a force of leadership. And that is, he reminds me how many times in the few times that I met Kofi Annan in person, there was none that I have not heard him comment on youth and leadership. And so we all know that, and I think it's useful to remind ourselves here in this podcast about that key principle. But let's talk a little bit, seen from your perspective, of the role of youth in democratizing multilateralism, and also the challenges of digital platforms and modern democracy, because it's an enabler. It's also potentially a tool for disinformation. Actually, disinformation, not potentiality, is there, but potentially also derailing entire democratic processes, for example. So what do you see from the Kofi Annan Foundation perspective?
No, these are actually two issues, both the digital threats to democracy and youth participation, that are indeed at the core of our work. And yes, youth leadership and inclusion have been from the start a major pillar of Kofi Annan's Foundation's work because of his own belief. I mean, he has this very famous quote that you're never too young to lead and never too old to learn. And so he pushed very much for the inclusion of young people in decision-making processes, and we continue this work. I mean, for me, it is always a source of personal regret that until recently I saw that the United Nations, there are loads of youth programs from all agencies, some excellent ones, you know. When I was here at UNOG, we used to run, and they're still going, excellent information programs and youth programs of work with young people. But the problem is that we haven't really managed to bring them in the decision-making process themselves, both in the delegations, representative of member states, where thank God, a lot of progress has been made in having more balanced, gender-balanced delegations. A lot of progress has been made, but you haven't seen that type of progress in terms of age representation. The fact is that today, 50% of the world is younger than 30. 50% of the world. And if you go to any UN conference around the world, what is the percentage of people who are younger than 30 that you will see actually voting? I'm not saying in a nice, pretty youth summit on the side, you know, which is many young people have described as tokenism. And I agree with them. It's important to have them. Their voices must be heard, but they must be also part of the decision making. And, you know, within the UN system itself, the people who work for the system, the secretariats have been unable to rejuvenate their workforce. And that is really, for me, a source of immense dissatisfaction. Today, across the UN system, less than 3% of workers, men and women, are younger than 30. So less than 3%, 50% of the population. You see the disconnect here. So we have to make a significant effort in this regard. I'm so happy that a big part of the Secretary General's common agenda focuses on this, focuses on youth inclusion and focuses on future generation, because it's not only about the young people who are alive today, but it's about, as some, there is a whole movement of people looking at what they call the next 8 billions. Where will the next 8 billion people be born? You know, what will we do with them? How do we take care of their needs? And the Secretary General really has already planted the seeds in our common agenda of all these important matters. And hopefully the Summit for the Future, it will also take care of that aspect. So we are really hoping that some significant changes will come out of this process. The second part of your question was about digital technologies. And yes, we, as I mentioned early on in the podcast, there was a report on democracy and elections in the digital age that the foundation produced a few years ago, and now we're implementing some parts of the recommendations of this commission. Overall, yes, there can be really positive aspects to digital technologies, for instance, access to information. We know that in some countries, traditional media are very controlled, and therefore platforms such as Facebook have allowed information to flow more freely. This is true. The negative side of the coin, of course, is that it has also allowed disinformation to flow very freely. And there is no doubt that today one of the big curses of democracies is disinformation. And so we try to work on, for instance, making sure that in the context of an electoral campaign, politicians commit to proper behavior online. So we have developed digital codes of conduct for politicians. But this is just really scraping the surface. We are very worried that artificial intelligence will turbocharge disinformation and will reduce the costs of disinformation and allow, because at the moment, social media help spread disinformation faster. But we are worried that artificial intelligence tools will allow also the creation of disinformation very fast and at a very low cost. So we are also trying to see with others who are equally concerned how you can set regulations or standards for artificial intelligence in a way that it will not favor disinformation.
Maybe we can take the conversation now to a little bit beyond now. Being now stronger, based on this exploration of the nexus, we have identified a few things. We also said that the nexus deserves more exploration because it's actually very intricate. But we know there are things there that are important to both democracy as a value, as a system of government, and multilateralism, as I like to say, as the only way forward for nation states, for peoples. We, the people, in terms of global, and only one way possible to go about things is to work together. We can do that well, we can do that horribly bad, but that's the only way. So, at the same time, Multilateralism is really now about the rise of non-state actors. So we see the civil society, we see the youth coming in, not enough, you said it rightly, but hey, in 20 years, the landscape demographically will be very different. So where are all these forces are going, with what ideas, how multilateralism is becoming something different than purely a governmental or intergovernmental space. So I like to see Agenda 2030, the Paris Agreements and others as precursors to more inclusive, if not democratic, intergovernmental processes. That is to say, Agenda 2030 has not been decided at the table by government representatives alone. Those approved it, yes, but it was built much more inclusively than anything before. So we could hope that from the summit of the future, for example, something similar may emerge. It's impossible for the international community to roll back from Agenda 2030 because that is really a cornerstone of how we draft this, let's call them overarching political agendas. So do you see this as exceptions now? Things have slipped through the old way of doing international business by member states, or an emerging trend? Can we look beyond now with hope that it will become more inclusive and participatory, or maybe you like to call that democratic?
Yes, I mean, I don't think we have a choice. And the Secretary General himself, I said, you know, multilateralism must become much more inclusive, which is also another way of saying it. And this is where you see, very interestingly, again, the parallel between democracy and multilateralism. Because everywhere in established democracies, the big trend today is to say that you need a more participatory democracy where citizens are listened to and contribute to decision-making also much more than they used to, so that a recognition that the elections and then designated representatives that will make all the decisions for you, whether it's in a national government or whether it's in the General Assembly of the UN, is just not good enough anymore. So you see this parallel trend. The big trend in, for instance, in many countries in both the north and south is citizens' assemblies, where you get people around a certain subject to really people from all walks of life to discuss, you know, what are their needs, what are their concerns, what are possible solutions. And they can yield very creative solutions that maybe parliamentary processes, as important and fundamental as they are, cannot yield. And you see it exactly at the same time, as you said very rightly, happening in the multilateral world, where, yes, the multilateral system is a system of sovereign member states, but you see that a lot of the advocacy, a lot of the policy setting, a lot of the agenda setting is done by a multitude of different actors, including civil society, youth groups, and so on. So absolutely, and this is the only way the multilateral system will survive, because to survive, to retain its credibility, it has to yield the solutions we need, in particular with regard to climate change, with regard to the emerging technologies. I mentioned artificial intelligence earlier. It's obvious that the type of process, of reflection process that is going on, and we are participating in discussions at the moment with others on the governance of artificial intelligence, those discussions do not only involve member states. That's happening at the ITU, for instance, the International Telecommunication Union. You have academics, you have people from tech companies, you have civil society organizations that are participating in this very complex discussions. And I think that's more and more the model of what's going to happen. You know, we also see the emergence of hybrid organizations, such as, for instance, in Geneva. We have so many of these new hybrid organizations that are still part of the multilateral ecosystem of International Geneva, but are very different in their governance, such as Gavi, the Global Alliance for Vaccines. And I think there's going to be more and more of this type of organizations that are more reactive, more flexible, that have the expertise needed, because one of the things that is very concerning is that governments and political leaders in general do not have all the expertise needed to deal with the very complex challenges coming our way, whether in the technology sector or climate change and so on. So they need to be able to rely on the expertise and the views of a wide range of actors and not only rely on themselves.
There is also this need to reconnect the interest of we, the people, of the citizens, the individuals, irrespective of the form of government, of the countries they live in, to the multilateral table where vital decisions are made, no longer for trade tariffs, etc., which already were enough intrusive in my life as an individual, of course, because that make the prices go up or down, but life deciding, life and death, elements like climate change, the future of migration, the immense pandemic of inequalities, for example. So is there one or two or three tools that you've been seeing at the foundation, how to reconnect these interests that are more situated at the individual level at the larger table of multilateralism? In a way, we could flip that question and ask you, you know, how can we equip multilateral practices with more democratic tools? Are there examples there?
Listen, I don't know whether there are recent examples, but there is a lot of proposals on the table. I would like to mention the fantastic lecture given by Prime Minister Mia Mottley of Barbados last year on the margins of the General Assembly session. She gave the first ever Kofi Annan lecture. And she laid out a very clear vision of what a more equitable multilateral system would look like, and in particular, what a more equitable international financial system would look like. Because when you talk about in inequities, the system today is rigged against some countries, and in particular with the recent increase in interest rates around the world, a lot of countries are in serious debt, and the governments have to spend maybe 50% of their income servicing the debt instead of spending those funds on education and health. So when you come back down to the people, to the needs of the people, the system today tends to be rigged against the people, you know? So there are very clear calls for a complete revamp of the international system. And basically, one is a revamp of the international financial institutions, and two, there's constant calls, and rightly, for a reform of the Security Council, which I mentioned in my first podcast with you, Francesco, in the first time I came to the next page. There cannot be a credible UN without the reform of the Security Council. When I talked about the next 8 billion, do you know that more people will be born, for instance, in Ethiopia over the next 50 years than in the whole of the European Union? More people will be born in Nigeria over the next 50 years than in the United States. So how can we not have Africa, for instance, without a permanent members in the Security Council? That is not going to work, you know, for the legitimacy of the multilateral system. So I think those two main issues, the Security Council reform that goes at the heart of the legitimacy of the United Nations, and then the reform of the international financial institutions that go really to back we the people and the interest of the people in the world. I think those two main areas will be fundamental to the democratization of the multilateral system.
Before we wrap up our episode today, Corinne, I wanted to ask you one thing that's been on my mind since I heard you talk about really the nexus between democracy as an enhancement force for multilateralism. And the question is this. I'd be curious to know, once you spell out these negative trends, you said we're back to the 80s in terms of the presence of democracy in the world of humans. What is the strategy and the work that you do at the foundation to preserve democracy in the international arena or to counter this evolution, if possible?
Well, we work at different levels. One is at the advocacy level, and all this work, for instance, in bringing back democracy at the heart of the multilateral world is very much part of this type of advocacy work that we do, and we are part of, for instance, something which is called the European Partnership for Democracy, which is an alliance of organizations concerned with the promotion of democracy that are based in Europe but that are active all over the world. So that's one of the kind of work we do. We do also work on the ground very clearly during electoral processes to make sure that they happen. We don't do electoral observation, but to make sure that they happen in a way that they yield a government that is really representative of the interests of the people and that they don't lead to more instability, but that, on the contrary, to a constructive government afterwards. And we work on the issues of managing the threats of disinformation, managing and reducing the threats of digital technologies to democracy. And finally, we work to reinvigorate the faith that young people have in democratic processes. Because as you said very rightly, they will be the ones ruling the world tomorrow. And you have to plant the seeds to make them see. And I'm very confident in that generation. They do absolutely have a natural tendency for transparency, inclusiveness, participation. And so we just try to explain to them some of the processes that can ensure that solid democracies are in place, some of the institutions and processes. So we work with them. We work on youth leadership, but really in planting the seeds and making them interested in democracy again, because that is one of the worrying trends as well, is that young people think that in some cases democracy has not delivered, you know? So we want to re-engage them in this field. And one of the very simple ways we do that is from now on, from as of this year, we're going to give every year a Kofi Annan Next Gen Democracy Prize. That will be presented at the Athens Democracy Forum in September. And we have an absolutely wonderful awardee. We have already selected the first awardee. She's from Zimbabwe. She's an amazing young woman. So this is how, by highlighting the work that young, extraordinary young people do around the world, we hope to sort of re-energize their interest in democracy.
We'll be waiting for the reveal of the name of the young Zimbabwean lady who won your first award. Your final thoughts, what would you like our audience and perhaps our younger audience to remember from this episode?
I would like them to remember that democracy, like multilateralism, are not abstract concepts. They were both set up to make sure that the interest of all are represented and taken care of. So it's just that these are concrete things that happen in the General Assembly, in the Economic and Social Council, at the World Health Organization, in their national parliaments, in their local city halls. These are things that affect their lives on a daily basis, and that they have to be involved. They have to step in, they have to be involved, and that all of them can be involved. Even in countries where the democratic space is quite constrained, there are always ways to be involved and to try to move the needle.
Very, very wise. Is there any flagship publication or any report that it's upcoming and we should alert our audience, you know, what they should be looking forward to from the Kofi Annan Foundation in the next, you know, few months?
A specific report, not really, but if people are interested, yes, we do publish very regularly information about upcoming elections or about, as I said, the role of extraordinary young people around the world. So I would just say, just look at all these examples of things that are done, and hopefully that will give you that will put a smile on your face in these quite somber times. We try to showcase positive examples that are happening around the world.
Wonderful. Well, All is left now is to say a big thank you for taking the time to be on the next page with us again. Corimo Malvagnon, Executive Director of the Kofi Annan Foundation. All the best to you.
Thank you, Francesco. Really glad to be here.